Are you overwhelmed by motherhood and barely keeping your head above water? Are you confused and frustrated by how all the other moms make it look so easy? You can't figure out how to manage the chaos in your mind, your home, or your family. I get you, mama. Parenting with ADHD is hard. Here is your permission slip to let go of the Pinterest-worthy visions of organization and structure fit for everyone else. Let's do life like our brains do life. Creatively, lovingly, and with all our might. When we embrace who we are and how our brains work, we can figure out how to live our lives successfully, and in turn, lead our families well. At the end of the day, we just want to be good moms, but spoiler alert, you are already a great mom. ADHD does not mean you're doomed to be a hot mess, mama. You can rewrite your story from shame spiral to success story. And I'll be right here beside you to cheer you on. Welcome to Motherhood in ADHD. Hey there, successful mama. Have you ever witnessed something really beautiful and totally missed how special it was in that moment? And it wasn't until it was over that you realized just how special that moment was. Well, these two episodes that you're about to hear are just that. Back in July, I volunteered with ADDA, which is the nonprofit that helps adults with ADHD thrive, and they hosted AGGA, a global gathering for an innovative way of doing an international conference to learn about your ADHD. Now, if you're not familiar with ADDA, go check them out. They have really solid resources and support groups for a membership that's totally affordable. It's not even 10 bucks a month. Head over to add.org and check them out. Now, during this conference, one of the events was a women's town hall, and a couple hundred women showed up. Board member Michelle Price first hosted four of the original women who set out to start the conversations about women with ADHD back in the day. This event was followed by a second conversation of trailblazers, women in the BIPOC community who are stepping up and sharing their story of having ADHD, especially as a woman of color. Now, at the time of the event, I was actually moderating the questions, which was totally overwhelming, to be totally honest. And it wasn't until we were well into the event, like a solid hour, hour and a half, before I realized what I was witnessing before me. The honesty and the brokenness, the hope and the healing, the persistence and the courage, seeing women in community. It is my honor to share with you these conversations, honoring the women who have come before us and the women who are stepping up now to spearhead change in the ADHD community, in how ADHD is perceived in the world around us, and how it's talked about, especially in communities of color, where it's particularly not safe to talk about your weaknesses. Now, because this was a very long event, I'm breaking it up into two parts. In the first section, you'll have guests Lori Dupar, Liz Lewis, Terry Matlin, and Linda Rogley. And in the second part, we have guests Inger Shea Colsey, Sudita Kasturi, and Victoria Navarro. You will also hear from the audience, as this was an interactive event. Now, fair warning, we were using a brand new technology, so you will hear us learning throughout this event. And I am always proud of us ADHDers for being willing to tackle new and innovative things. If you are here for these kinds of conversations, the openness and the sharing with a group of women who have brains who work like yours, you are my kind of people. You deserve to have a safe space to talk with women whose brains work like yours and grow those relationships. You deserve a space to be yourself. You deserve a space for rest and relaxing and taking care of you. And you also deserve some good food in a hotel room all to yourself. So that sounds like your kind of deal. You are invited to join our ADHD Moms Luxury Retreat that I am hosting here in Houston, Texas. It is an all-inclusive event, so once you get your ticket, you just show up and I take care of everything for you. I take care of the planning, taking care of the meals, the hotel. You get to turn off the mental load and just enjoy the freedom of being there and taking care of only yourself. Most of the decisions I'm going to take care of for you, so you simply get to enjoy. And we are going to sit together and have these kinds of conversations in person. And while there's definitely not going to be several hundred women there, it's a small group of women, I want to sit with you and spend quality time getting to know you, answering your questions about ADHD, for you to know that you're not weird because of this weird quirky thing you do, that the rest of us in this community do a lot of those things too. And knowing that you're not alone is one of the best gifts that you can give yourself, along with taking care of you. So put yourself on the priority list and come on to Houston October 7th through 9th. You can reserve your ticket at patriciasung.com/ADHD-mom-retreat. So I'll see you in Houston next month to hold conversations in person just like these. So join me now as you come behind the scenes into this event that was so beautifully hosted by Ada. And hear what are the women in our community talking about right now? What's on their hearts? What are they struggling with? Let's hear from this growing community in the ADHD world of women who are world changers. Welcome to Ada's Women's Town Hall during the Global Gathering event in July 2020. And if you haven't listened to part one, hit back an episode and listen to the beginning of this conversation.
And Amber, do you want to kind of say something? You want to have something that you might want to say to open up and kind of make a shift? And it looks like everybody's really interested, so if you guys want to stay and hang out.
Yes, well, Stacey is here somewhere. That's how we do, right? Is always bringing it and being real with what's going on here with, BIPOC community and ADHD. So again, I want to thank everybody who's here watching and the previous panel that we kind of jumped in on, because they weren't here first doing the work, and it's hard work, but it's work that we all love, right? It's our passion, and that's why we're here. And what happened for me is when I was at the 2019 conference, where I didn't even know they had an international ADHD conference, it was here in Philadelphia where I live. And what I noticed after being there for 4 days, and I don't know how many breakouts they have from like 8 in the morning to maybe like 8 at night, and I only saw a handful of people of color. And I was very confused. I was like, do they not know it's here? Or they don't feel welcome? Or like, why in a city, especially in a city that has, I think, a 40% population of black and brown folk, why there was no one there with a face for ADHD, nobody giving any type of a talk or anything. When I started to ask around, nobody had an answer, so that's when I was like, oh, I guess I need to be an ADHD coach. And as I started on that journey, it's like, I guess I need to figure out a way for black people to find coaches that look like them, if that's what they look like. Because every day, and I mean every day, I get several messages about not being able to find a coach and or a clinician that looks like them, because there's just, for some people, a certain level of familiarity or just a certain way that you would like to be seen or not have to necessarily worry about having to explain some stuff. And sometimes there's just like not a lot of cultural humility out there, because I think it's just something that it feels like it's like, 20 years, but that's something that's actually pretty new. Right? So here we are with the second wave, trying to bring these things to our communities. So with Suditha and Victoria and Michelle and Stacey Michelle, we're here to talk about all of this. So I don't know, Michelle, do you have questions you want to do first?
I have a couple of questions. What do you think we need to do to increase awareness of this and maybe decrease stigma so that our people will actually pay attention? Because we have a lot of issues with stigma and the mental health stuff and, oh, she's dingy, she ADHD, you know what I mean? Like, what do you think it would take to change that?
Well, it is very interesting. And we were talking earlier, and I mentioned that it is a safety concern at some levels. But I do feel talking about it, at first finding a community of people for you at first to talk about it, because sometimes we do feel like it's unsafe to talk about it in different places. And sometimes we aren't sure what to do with it. There is so much masking because, we are afraid to be able to just be ourselves. So when you're walking out there, a lot of times just with a heightened sense of that there's something's always wrong, that somebody's always looking at it that way. As a mother, my nervous system's on a million because I have a black son with ADHD and what that can mean for him. So when I'm walking around with all those different things, it's really a safety concern to kind of be like, yes, what people think about what ADHD is compared to maybe what it is, that I might not be taken seriously, or something might happen to me, or something might happen to my child. So when you can speak in a community first and feel okay and learn some language and realize you're not crazy or that you're stupid, or realize that the stigma is out there, but we're going to have to deal with it in some way, getting to educate some of the people who, like I said, who want to know. And sometimes there's some people that don't stay in your life, right? Sometimes that happens too. But the way to be comfortable with that, I think, first is to start with community.
So I want to echo what Inger said, that change happens, starts with us. And if we own our own ADHD and understand and educate ourselves about our own ADHD and why, for example, I behave in a certain circumstance a certain way, then that starts a ripple effect, because then I can educate my family, I can educate my community. I know in the South Asian community, we have very strong familial and societal structures in there. So we start with ourselves and move out, and it may be small, it may be one small room at a time, one congregation at a time, one medical practice at a time. That ripple will have an effect as we move ourselves out and get a bigger and wider voice.
The other thing for me, I mean, for me, advocacy, personal advocacy is everything. Just be as outspoken as you feel comfortable with, not forcing yourself or anything, but and just stressing out both the strengths as well as the difficulties. Do it in the way that's personal to you. I mean, I use humor. We joke about this all the time. I can laugh at myself. It's not okay for you to laugh at me. But I can laugh at myself. I can make jokes on this. And making jokes or laughing decompresses what's going on. I mean, it was hard for me to realize I forgot my kids. Yeah. But just being able to say to someone, you know, how I'm not feeling so bad about it or whatever. Or so it's like, first of all, be personal, be outspoken. And the next thing is, we should be looking at what other communities did that was successful. Yes, like the LGBT, I don't know, I mean, come on, it's like impossible to say that. LGBT, yeah? The
LGBTQIA.
Oh my God, okay, yes. I have dyslexia, imagine I keep moving all those things around. The autistic community, you know, it's like they did some things that we should be looking at. How were they so successful? Because, for example, for me, for example, parents with autistic children or children belonging to the autistic spectrum were so outspoken because they had to, as opposed to, well, to us, that we realized some things. I have four children with ADHD, yeah? four boys. It was amazing, and it was such a struggle. We have to speak. We have to see what did they do to get the word out there and just, you know, follow the model. I think that would be an intelligent thing to do. What did they do to become so well known that we are not doing?
One of the things I think is use of the word neurodiverse as opposed to autism. I mean, that's kind of what seemed, as I was watching this whole thing take off, that was one of the things that I saw. And I think that word has less of a charge to it for people. They can deal with that. Like, a lot of people can deal with that word. And then once they get the word, you can't learn anything new unless you can understand some other things. And so that gave it the space to be able to, now you see it everywhere. So that's...
Oh, we are part of that, yeah?
We are. We're part of
that. We have to own our space. We have to speak up. We have to actually identify as neurodivergent. And I think that would help us.
Some of the things I've heard, like when Linda said about our periods, right? Now, I thought it was, I don't know what, me, there has to be something going on. I mean, so many black women have fibroids. So many black women have these problems. Like, they call them female problems, but we have so many. Both me and my daughter had hysterectomies by the time we were 36. And so if we could educate around those kinds of things sometimes, maybe that would help too. Educate around the things that they're facing every single day so that they understand that there could be a cause for that, or there could be something. These are some of the things to consider. But, the doctors just don't seem to be with it. So we really are going to have to learn how to help ourselves.
Well, I think it's interesting, too, like you mentioned, fibroids and things like that. There are certain things that happen for black women and women of color, like, so disproportionately for the population. And I know that there is a bit of a link between, like, that and autoimmune disorders and ADHD, but there's, like, very little research. I know for black people, and I'm not sure
to these in Victoria, how much research there is around your population. You know, when you talk about stigma, people in my population, it's like I am on the executive committee of Philadelphia Chat. We, every week somebody wants to do a study, and people are like, no, 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 no.
Yeah, Tuskegee, right?
Yeah, we're not.
Yeah. If anybody has questions, you can come up to the podium and get ready to do that, because I think we'll be ready to maybe take some. But
yeah, that's a big number. Because it's like, we need to have some studies if people are willing, right? You were talking about like people not being willing, if they're willing. But when you're a population that for, there's a reason that people don't want to be studied. But it doesn't leave a lot of room for the type of growth we'd like to see. And so, like I said, part of starting the association is to start bringing professionals that look like you. So if there is a study, you know, you're more likely to talk to somebody that looks like you, or at least consider maybe what it would be, because they could maybe speak in your language or take the time to be able to explain some things and be the ones that are doing the studies. Because what I've found too is if somebody of color is not in the room when they're making up these studies, then they're not looking for anything that's going to benefit us anyway. You know, having us, I think, be a force in different places is going to start changing the movement. So my thought is, like, let's start bringing people together like we are here, and then together we can start doing things. So if there's physicians that I know can diagnose other people with ADHD, I know that they're going to go, and they're at least going to get a real diagnosis, right? Because you need to know who really do, or if it's something else. Because if it's not ADHD, you need to, you know, deal with that. But you'll get one. They won't just dismiss you. And then, you know, that can have a movement, because it's like, oh, if I see these other clinicians doing it and they're okay with it, then maybe some others will, right? There are other Black coaches around, and they can start seeing all the people that I'm on a wait list, be able to get them coaching to then, you know, be able to deal and manage and lean on their strengths of ADHD. Then that can start a movement, because more people have ADHD, I think any statistical data is saying, especially like I think the pandemic, the, you know, for anybody who's masking real hard, like that went away. So when people start seeing other people doing well, you're like, I want some of that. To me, that's the cycle we need to kind of move in. That's just where I fall in.
Again, if you guys have questions, come to the podium, ask your question.
We did have the one from earlier about people asking Sudhita for specific examples of what she shares.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
To answer that specific question, what I did is I put together a small presentation about my own journey with ADHD, how I was diagnosed and what, you know, how my teen years went. There was a lot of passion and very little common sense and a lot of rebellion just because I never felt heard in my younger years. And I had very supportive parents, but nobody knew about ADHD. So, and then I put together a presentation on how ADHD presents in the different age groups and how it's different in men and women. It was a short presentation, 10, 15 minutes, and then left open for questions from them and how I could support these practices, right? What did I offer to them and what they could do for me? And a lot of it is my OBGYN added me to her preferred vendor list. There are a whole bunch of other doctors who offered to now take my cards and put it in their practice because they know it's a thing. They just don't know where to go and how to get help for these people. And their patients are asking them, hey, I have ADHD, and what do I do? But they don't know where to send them. And these are not just practitioners who are people of color. It's all different spectrums, all everywhere else. And even the therapists know that what they can do in therapy is different, and what we do as coaches is very, very different. And it's a synergistic approach towards ADHD that we take. So I think it's just a question of getting out there, getting information. If you want to reach out to me, I have my presentation. I can just put together the bullets and share it with anybody else who would like to, who would like more information.
If you don't mind, before you start, Victoria, I'd like you to do it too. We got together and had like a 3-hour conversation, the four of us. That was really great before this. And I was so struck by both of your stories. So if you, Sudhita, if you could tell like a bit of your story, and Victoria, you know, if you want to answer the question, tell your story, because I think it's important for people out there to hear our stories, right? Because I think that that is part of bringing this awareness that we speak of ADHD. So if you wouldn't mind.
So Victoria, you want to answer the question first, and then we do your story, and I'll come back.
I want you to forget.
The one thing that I was going to say before I forget is one of the ways to go research-wise, yeah, we all keep thinking about quantitative studies, and I know I'm going to sound so nerdy, but, well, just bear with me. And so quantitative studies, they do need, you need a lot of money to do those, yeah, because you need to have, like, enough bases and everything, all the things that you have to do to publish your stuff, yeah. But if you go into qualitative studies, and that's, we are so good at those because we are good at having real in-depth conversations that are actually so much more interesting because they will give you all the nuances that someone has because our stories are so important to be told and they do make a difference when you listen to them. Yeah? So the thing is, we keep thinking of these things as it's like, well, no one is going to care about my story or what. We should be having, I don't know, like 3,000 people are responding to Adderall better than whatever. And it's like, no, not really. You know, it's like we could do a lot of move things forward with this other kind of research. And if anyone is interested in that, I would really love to help because that's what I do. That's what I teach, yeah. And that's another way of even changing the way academia works. We are not getting into academia. Women in any color are not getting into academia with ADHD because we cannot do that stuff here. I mean, I have this problem. I have everything you can think of. So how can I think of myself as a scientist? And it's like, well, it's because I do another kind of science. Yeah, I do a science that is so much, talks to me and it talks to a lot of people. So my story is, I live in Argentina. I have four boys. They really struggle at school, especially my eldest. And I'm an absolute overachiever. You know, I have 4 or 5 careers. I don't count them anymore. And I have 3 degrees, master degrees, and I'm working for my PhD, and nothing seemed to be enough. And my children gave me the answer, yeah, that they have dyslexia and ADHD, and it's like, listening of what was it, you know, like the characteristics and everything is like, well, that's me. And I was 51. We were in the middle of the pandemic over here, and I thought I was bipolar because my highs and my lows were so high, so low that the only explanation was I have to be bipolar, with absolutely the utmost respect for everyone that is within that disorder. That's not who I was. It's just like my untreated ADHD got me into that. And just knowing that it had a name and knowing that most of what I do, every second of my day has to do with this. And most of what my children did, I mean, they were not misbehaving, they were not wanting to drive me crazy or whatever. It was just their ADHD and my ADHD. And so when I learned about this, I was, how can anyone know about this and not speak about it, study it? No, do whatever they can. So I dropped everything and I created a social enterprise and I got into ADA and I'm just focusing on doing this and advocating for this.
Well, that was great. What always strikes me is it's like we say what we can't do versus what we can do and how many degrees, so many people I know, like, you know, how many degrees and PhDs, and still there is that part inside you where it's like, it's never enough. So where that kind of shame just seems to always hit. But I think it, you know, with a lot of things that have just gone on in our lives, you know, women of color, I think that that's important to note. And I don't know, Sudhisa, you're not on my, I don't know. Oh, there you are. The screen keeps moving around. Can you tell your story, too? I just think it would be great for everyone to hear.
And then, Sarah, I see you, and you have a question. We'll answer your question after that.
So my journey, I was always the different quirky kid, right? I felt too intensely. I was passionate about women's rights and animals and how we treated animals and the environment. And nobody around me, at least in my peer group, seemed to care. I was just used to not fitting in. I had a few group of friends who, I think they kind of got me, and so they supported me. But I went through my teens, my 20s, actually until my early 20s, and I met my husband, who's neurotypical, and who got me, and who seemed to be absolutely fine with my quirkiness and oddities and all of that stuff, and seemed more fascinated by that than anything else, so that was wonderful. And then in my early 30s, I ended up having all these weird symptoms. I was coordinating a huge event with 300 people, and all these weird things were showing up, which ended up to a neurological evaluation where they suspected a brain tumor. But the neuropsych eval revealed that I had ADHD. So at my house, the ADHD diagnosis was a party because, hey, it was a better option than having a tumor, right? But there was always this thing of being something missing, something that I couldn't lay my hands on. I had academic degrees, but I heard that statement that I was never lived up to my potential.
Yeah.
In some ways, I was too aggressive about what I wanted to go out and get, or too ambitious, but in some ways, I was lazy and non-ambitious. And so there was all this stuff that I was dealing with that I didn't always understand. Then I became a homeschooling parent, and so there's me with my ADHD, two boys with ADHD, and we're trying to get school done and get these kids moved along in the grades. And I'm teaching science because my background is molecular biology and chemistry. And I'm teaching science to the kids, and it was wonderful to create the classes and have all these interesting questions, but grading drove me crazy because it was the same question. I had to look at 10 different answers, the same repetitive information that was very difficult for me. And, you know, we didn't know my boys had ADHD at that time. You know, you'd think we'd suspect that with me having it, but I think somewhere I hoped that they were more like my husband and not like me. But we eventually, all of us got our diagnoses. I already had mine, they both got diagnosed. So we tell my husband that he's the diverse one and we're the typicals in the household because, hey, there's three of us and only one of him. And then coaching, actually our neuropsychologist, clinical psychologist asked me if I would like to become a coach. And I had struggled to find coaches for my own children, which is what led me to get an education, become a coach. And I think I finally feel with all that knowledge of becoming a coach, learning about coaching practices, I have come into my own. And I think because my kids have coaches, it's not me. I was the homeschooling parent, but not the coach. And I think the biggest thing for us is there's a sense of peace because we all are learning about ourselves and appreciating each other's creativity. Both my boys are very different, but very creative. And then we've got the neurotypical parent to kind of calm things out in the family. And I think that's why I think I feel so strongly about education, about educating yourself, educating your community, going out there, speaking, whatever you're, maybe it's 5 people you start with, maybe it's 10 people you start with. It doesn't have to be a room full of people, but you go out there and you let people know it's okay to be happy and easy. We're wonderful people. And we just need, and you know, ask them, where am I being asked to fit into a neurotypical world? How will they live in our world? Flip the belief system, flip the equation, say, come into my world and live, you know, see me and not ask me. You fit into my world. They're not going to fit in either. So how about we coexist and find ways for all of us to work well together? Is it idealistic? Maybe. But I think it's possible.
Absolutely. We're going to create. I have this phrase that says, create or it did. And everybody says, I love that. And I always forget that I even have it there. But I learned that from the client that told me I had ADHD. That was what he would always sign off with. And it got to me because I thought, ooh, I can create it, right? I can create a great day and how I want my day to be. And so that's what I always think. Thank you for that, Sunita. I don't know if there's any other questions.
We do have 2 audience questions if you want to go to those 2.
Oh, good. Thank you. What are they?
One was asking about, she was screened by her therapist to have ADHD, but she was asking about the process of, do I need an actual diagnosis for medication and how does she go about that? And then the second question is from Connie. It says, are there practitioners here that are coming from a lens of decolonizing neurodiversity, separating ADHD traits from the Eurocentric work and education paradigms that highlight the deficits of our neurodiversity and minimize or sideline the strengths?
Those are the questions. The first one, it is an actual diagnosis when you go to a psychotherapist. If you like medication, then you have to go to a psychiatrist in the United States. So they get a different diagnosis. So a psychotherapist and a psychologist can diagnose you, but neither one can give you medication. If you like medication, you have to go to a psychiatrist. Your psychologist might give you some testing. Psychotherapist and your psychiatrist will not. They're going to do more of a history and talk to you. But what people also need to know is when you go to a psychiatrist, it's going to be this short visit. You're not getting this long visit. They're not going to be doing any type of therapy with you. They're only looking at symptoms to try to make decisions. And so people are always shocked, like, it was 15 minutes. And it's like, you're lucky you got 15 minutes. Psychologists and psychotherapists are going to be able to sit with you, do therapy, work through some, you know, issues, be able to give you some skills building, and then, and some psychotherapists and a coach, which are two separate things, and I don't want to take up the time explaining the two of them, but a coach can help you kind of get more, like, to your goals, right? We partner with our clients because they know what they want to do, they have goals, and we partner with them and, like, kind of help you across the bridge where your ADHD comes up that stops you, to allow you to have the life you want. So that's that question. And then the other question was about decolonization. So it's like really interesting. And that's like a really big thing right now in therapy and, you know, I'm bringing it forth to coaching. When I first started doing therapy, because most of the constructs are on white males from like different countries, I started working, I couldn't work. I was like, did you just turn around and go to school and change your life and you can't do this? Once I started to be who I was in therapy, like be my whole human self, I've been very, very, very successful. And the same thing in coaching, where the constructs of, in therapy, like that whole blank kind of chair, like where you wouldn't know anything about me. I know the people that I know, they want to relate to me, right? The way that they're able to make progress is the fact that I see them as a whole human. And if they say something like man's out, and they're like, oh, where were you? Like, maybe you were on vacation. I would say, well, why would you ask that question? Versus, oh, I had a great time on vacation. Thanks for asking. Because without that relational part, right, or those parts where the way that the people who made these models, like generally they're white people, the way they see the world is not the way we see the world because we don't come up against it that way, right? We're coming up against it from the other angle. So when you look at it that way, and that's why a lot of times there's misdiagnosis, because they're already thinking that it should go a certain way. And in our lives, it doesn't go the way that they planned. So that's why many people get diagnosed with bipolar. Because if I came in talking about being so upset about my child, right, that I haven't slept in 3 days, if I talk about, like, you know, having an argument and my coworker just, like, didn't understand, right, because maybe, like, my ADHD, they're going to say things like the up and down with bipolar. Like, they won't even sometimes make that leap or, like, that thought process of ADHD. So, yes, decolonization is, thank goodness it's here. That's what we're trying to do. I'm going to be bringing some DEI to the conference.
Paper. Help me understand decolonize. What does that mean?
Well, as, you know, the person that she looks at, it is 10:30 here.
It is.
And, but also, you know, the way that the question was written is beautiful. I don't think I would have that language around it, but quickly, many of these constructs, I mean, you know, think about just even life. In life, the way that I experience life is not the same way that, you know, some of my white sisters might experience life or other people experience life. So when I have, like, generational trauma, right? So, like, I talk about my son, like, the reason why this is, like, very interesting to me. A lot of black parents will say bad things about their children, more like if you say, oh, how are they doing? Like, oh, they're all, you know, this stuff that they do. Where you thought of white parents will be like, oh, you know, my child's doing this thing and they're doing that thing. What it is when our children were sold, oh, you know, on the slave auction. If you say something, if you had a young buck they were going to take away, they take your kids away. We're used to having our families broken apart back then and the way some systems have happened now. So to fact that maybe I'm not sleeping as much as I need to sleep with somebody with ADHD, I might come in and say I was up because I was worried. So now you're manic. And then maybe I was
okay.
So when they look at it through the construct of their lens and don't take a moment to even consider my life, and we all have different lives, having those assumptions can really put people in such bad places. And that's what I try to say on a daily basis. I have many women, men too, that come to me and just, they are so misunderstood. They've had such a hard time. They've done so many things. They're very high achieving, but it never seems like enough, which is enough to really take you down. And they have to spend so much time with, like I said, aggression or microaggressions that it leaves no much bandwidth to be able to, like, manage your ADHD. So when we can work with the way that the people that come to us in the way we know to work with them, we make wonders. So it's not, you can't be with somebody who doesn't look like you, because I always, you know, I'm going to point out that my coach is a white man, right? But, and we work really well together. But we're
works for you to hear somebody that looks like you, that speaks in your language, there's nothing like it, and coaching saves lives. So,
Patricia, did you have another question?
Yes, there is one about recommendations for sleep. How do people with ADHD go to sleep with all the thoughts running around?
I really like what Natalo has to say, and I think it applies to us even more. It's first diagnosis, second medication, third treatment, and coaching. Yeah, and then you will get to all the other therapies or whatever you need. But first, we need our diagnosis. We need them to be as accurate as they can be, as big as they can be. We should be screened for any other comorbidities that we have. This one is a big one, because you get like, you have ADHD. What about all the rest? Yeah, what about my dyslexia, my dyscalculia, my dyspraxia? And like, whoa, my list is really, really, really long. And then you get someone that says, you cannot be within the autistic spectrum because you are like sociable or whatever. It's not like that. Yeah, so first, let's get a really, really the best diagnosis we can afford. It's the money best spent that you will do get, and we will keep on just talking about this, is we should be helping people get their diagnosis all over the world so then they can get educated and they can get treatment. But I think that would wrap it up for me.
Sudhisa, do you have something that you would like to add?
Yeah, I'd like to add something you said, Vinushka, is how each cultural society works is very different. And I think when you go into medical professionals or into communities, sometimes people don't recognize that. The South Asian society is not an individualistic society. We're a very interdependent society. We have multi-generational family. We have deep social roots. And those have to be taken into account when people are working with us. They don't necessarily always have to look like us, but they need to understand that we have these roots. And we can seek support from them. Like patient, we can seek support. If I am not good at getting on time somewhere, or I can't get all my tasks done and instead of labeling me a bad mother or whatever, how about seeking the support of my family to say maybe somebody else can help get the kids out the door in the morning and I'd be responsible for something else where my strength is. And that cultural competence and cultural humility, I think somebody said, is very important when you go in. And if you can find somebody who supports that journey, then you're fine. Like you, my coach is not South Asian. Well, there are hardly any. I don't think of any. I don't know. There are very few South Asian people out there. But I am with the coach I am with because he understands that my society and my culture is different and it is supportive and respectful of that. And definitely, Michelle, one other thing is changing that verbiage of it not being a deficit and a disorder. You know, it's a variable attention issue. It's a selective attention issue. And then maybe we all just go with neurodiversity as the way to, it's a broader word, but hey.
It's a broader umbrella. It's a broader umbrella term.
Yeah. Right? And I think the biggest thing for me is it's okay to be you. We're all in. I think that's the most important thing for me. That's where my happiness has come from, is to know that I am enough and who I am is enough.
Okay, we got two more questions.
Either the panel or people in the audience, I was interested in hearing stories from women from other countries that go through the struggles that we go through, but their country is less receptive to ADHD and the culture is where the women are lower than the men, if you don't understand what I'm saying.
So what we should be doing is, I think we should be sharing the information as much as we can, everywhere we can. It's still like a little white boy syndrome down here, you know, it's hyperactive syndrome. We are in that stage. I know other parts of the world, I'm lucky and privileged, and we spoke about this, the other day. I mean, and we are privileged to have our diagnosis, to have treatment, to be able to be here sharing with other people. So everything we can bring from outside into our countries, it's so big. You cannot start figuring out, it's like how big any piece of information is for our countries. So I think we should be focusing on how can we get as many people on board and in their language. I know this is a big one for me because I can speak English, but most of the people in my country can't. So we should be speaking in their language, trying to get as much, because it's like, and the other big thing for me, it's like, let's speak of we being a market, yeah? People can profit, not from us, but from, we can make it a business, and then doctors will be interested, doctors will be getting, you know, their certifications or their education or whatever, because they will be able to live from treating us and helping us. So I think that as much as advocacy as we can say, as much as speaking everywhere we can, I think that will get us, because all Latin America, all South America, Mexico down, we don't speak about this. If your child gets the diagnosis, it's like, well, you know what, but it's nothing. He's doing really fine. If he will outgrow it. It's amazing. They don't want to say it, you know. It's like the stigma is so, so high that they will not say it. They will actually tell you, and if you go and say, hey, how is your child doing with his ADHD, he's a person, he's like, what? Why would you say that? He's saying, I know they've been diagnosed, you know? It's like, you know, my four children have it, so why is this such a big for you, big thing? And so I think we should be speaking about that. How can we stigmatize all this stuff?
Yeah, we're definitely going to continue this conversation. We will be continuing this conversation, for sure. We got one more question from Teresa T, then we are going to wrap this up, and we could be here all night, as you can see. Teresa, there you are. How are you?
Hey, sorry about that. Yeah, I just was coming in to ask a question for one of our other attendees, and I can't go to sleep. I can't be on meds because then I really can't sleep, and I never feel rested. And so what she wants to know is, if you all can share some practices for better sleep hygiene or give some directions on next steps for how she can get help with improving her sleep.
So we can say what we know we should be doing. That doesn't mean that we actually do it. It's like, but there are some things, I mean, and I think you said the answer within, for me, you said the answer within the question. It's sleep hygiene, yeah. You shouldn't be doing this if you want to go to sleep in an hour. And it's like this thing that you shouldn't be eating 3 hours before you go to sleep, you shouldn't be working on your computer 2 hours before, and you shouldn't be watching social media or whatever, Netflix, an hour before you go. And we
are 3-2-1.
3-2-1, yeah.
3-2-1.
And that's what Brandon Bouchard says all the time, yeah, the 3-2-1, and that he really supports with research that this works. The thing is, we should be looking at how does that work with us with ADHD, you know? Because the thing for us is all this thing, and I know Sarah can give us a whole amazing information on this. It's like your dopamine levels, you cannot go to sleep because your dopamine is not there to help you get the sleep and can stay asleep. And then you are in very deep sleep when you have to wake up. So we should be looking at those things. You know, the cycle of our sleeps is even different than anyone else's. So it's not only how can we get to sleep and how can we stay asleep.
Stay asleep for me.
Yeah, and I think that's a big one that we should all be looking at and studying it together.
I hope that was helpful, everybody. So I am so grateful for everybody here. Everybody, let's press F like 3 times. Come on.
For hosting this, you know, and inviting me to lead it. It's like such an important conversation, and to have it on a global stage, just like so invigorating. And the questions are great. Thank you everybody for coming. Thank you for all your questions.
For more resources, classes, and community, head over to my website, motherhoodinadhd.com.